Mr. Henderson, reel 12. What was the picture at Gosford? Of course, you were obviously not the only unit there.
The only unit? I think there must have been 2 million there. There was the roads were on the way down. We'd seen tanks parked at the right side of the road in columns. There was vehicles everywhere. There was the roads were jammed with pieces of artillery, and it was a massive picture of hustle and bustle. And you have to see it to believe it. The place was soldiers everywhere. Not only British soldiers, there was Canadians and there was Poles and there was French soldiers and American soldiers. The south coast, all the way along that south coast, especially Portsmouth and Southampton, was just troops. It was just a big military camp. And we got into our little part, and the sea, because we're on the beach at this particular time, on the Hards. And there were ships everywhere. There were ships as far as you could see. And all were picking up, and how they knew which ones to pick up and how the soldiers knew which ships to get on. The arrangements, there's a word for this, a big posh word to use, about, I don't know, I forget it. But it was the plan. Who would... made this plan up, all this attention to detail. Every one of those little units would have to be looked after by somebody who it all fitted into one plan. And the times of sailing and the order of sailing, you couldn't all pull out together. Those that were in the first, we were in the front of the queue, and so we went out, I think we must have loaded more or less first. And we went out into Southampton water to go in on Monday morning, 6th of June.
You said the LCTs held five tanks, I think.
Five.
The actual process of moving out onto the ships using the Hards, how did that work?
The ramp came down, and you reversed up the ramp, and you went, there was two tanks side by side behind the at the end of the, just behind the, just in front of the cookhouse, and then two more, and then one in the centre. You couldn't put two at the, because they wouldn't get out. You had to have one just at the top of the ramp, and then the ramp came up, and the landing craft backed off into the water, and another one came in, loaded another troop, and that was the way it was done. And this is the way we would reverse. We loaded in the daylight, and it was rather funny that while we were loading, there was an iron railing on top of the stone balustrade. You know, there was an iron rail, and there was civilians leaning over there watching us load the tanks up. So There was no restriction on the civilians, which was rather a funny thing to us, you know. I don't suppose they could really keep the civilians off the streets, but because it was more or less on the street, you know. And they saw what was happening, and gave us a wave as we pulled off.
Were there any senior officers to see you off? Was anyone actually saying, good luck, chaps, and all this kind of thing?
The colonel of the regiment. Not the colonel...
Commanding the regiment.
Not the commanding officer.
The honorary one.
But the honorary one. Saw us up. And standing beside him, when he took the salute as we pulled out of Petworth, there was a chap that wasn't allowed to go. A chap called Tong from Birkenhead, a Wallasey. And because he wasn't quite 19... he wasn't allowed to go with us. So he was broken-hearted. He was, after all the training he'd done, he was broken-hearted because he hadn't quite reached the age of 19. And the age, no soldier was allowed to go into action under 19 years of age. But when you go and visit the graves in Normandy, you see dozens of graves of 17-year-olds. And many, many 18-year-olds. So I don't know what happened. They must have slipped through the net or given the wrong age. As it was, the boys of that, they wanted to be in it. You know, you couldn't keep them out. We were all so excited. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. And even when we got into action, it was still a game at first. It was a huge game for the first week or two. And then as the casualty lists came up, as they gave the lists of people, of your friends that were dead, it wasn't a game anymore. And hatred. And it became bitter, very, very bitter. But I think if I'd known that I was going to live through it, I don't think any of us expected to live through it, especially when the casualties kept coming in. And I certainly didn't expect to live through it. But if I'd known I was going to live through it, I think I would have enjoyed it, because it was exciting.
You were all obviously keyed up, as you say, and excited with the adventure ahead of you. What was the effect of the 24-hour delay?
Oh, it was terrible, because we were out on the... It gave us an extra 24 hours on the landing craft. The landing craft weren't comfortable. There were a flat-bottomed thing. It wasn't too bad in Southampton water. The waves weren't high there. But once we got out into the channel, those waves hit us and the landing craft went up in the air and come down with a terrible crack. It even moved some of the tanks, because there was one tank that slid and couldn't disembark at the other end, one of the DDs. That's why there was only 34. Actually, we had more than that, but they didn't all get off the landing craft on D-Day morning, because they'd been moved about with the terrible weather. But it was terrible. Is anticlimax the right word? We were so, this is it. And then we didn't even know whether it was going to be on. It was supposed to be cancelled. And after all that, and to have it cancelled, it was heartbreaking, really heartbreaking. But anyway, when it came that it was back on again, or it was on, and we moved out of the... I think the first sign that happened was some of the landing craft started to pass us in Southampton water. They started to move. And they were saying, look, they were our tanks that were moving out. And then suddenly ours started up and we said, we're off. And then we pulled out into the channel and we travelled through the night. It was a terrible journey.
Just immediately before we get to that, in the quiet moments of this very last hour, what are your thoughts? You're going in, you're going to be action, you don't even know if you're going to come out in those quiet moments.
I thought of my mother, and I was thinking of my family, and I was thinking of my Uncle Fred that had been killed. I was the only one of the family that was in the army, as my Uncle Fred was. Previously, he was killed in France. Those thoughts that went through your mind, thinking of my brothers and sisters and my mother, and how she'd be worrying, and what would she say if she could see me now, you know? Would she be proud, or would she be anxious, or how would she feel? But you could sort of just sit and think, and there were long hours, a lot of thoughts went through your minds, all kinds of thoughts. But the main thing, I think, is would you be still alive the following day? We knew the cattle were going to be very high. We thought the cattle would be a lot higher than they were.
What were you dressed in? Touched on this.
Overalls. We had our tank suits on. They weren't a two-piece outfit. They were a tank suit. They were a pair of denim overalls with map pocket. Yeah, pocket with. For pencils, you know, the little things for pencil holders. They were just like a single piece overall. And we had those until the first week in August. And then we were issued with what we called a zoot suit. It was supposed to be fireproof. It had a khaki lining. It was a light fawn outside, supposed to be fireproof, waterproof, heatproof, and they were warm. We could sleep in those at night. This was to see us through the winter. They were marvellous things, zoot suits. They zipped right away up the front, and right a double zip right up the front. This come down. You could almost turn them into a sleeping bag. They were a marvellous thing. We got those on the first week in August, quite out of the blue. Suddenly, we're told to collect these.
You'd have your revolver, I think you had, didn't you?
Sidearms, Smith & Wesson. Don't ask me the number, because I can't remember.
But well, let's come to the journey now. When you're on, you're setting off, you're sailing, and you did have a bad time, I think, with the weather.
Yes. The dress, your revolver, your belt and revolver, and your ammunition was on top of your overalls, and you had your hat on, your boots and gaiters.
Was your hat, by the way, the Berry?
Berry, yeah. But we had Blackberry. We had to wear our tin hats, unfortunately, which weren't like a civilian, like an infantry. They were straight. They were a straight sort
round
of...
Round and straight down your head.
Yes, yes. And those were our steel helmets. And we wore them all the time. And when we got over to the other side, the noise was the thing that hit you most of all. The incessant noise of gunfire and engines and things. And I got a terrible headache, and I had it for a fortnight until I got some aspirins from a tented hospital that we came across. But the journey, we were fed. I've been trying to think how we were fed on this thing. We were fed by the cooks on the... It was an American landing craft. And what we got all the time was mutton stew in a bucket. And they came out of this thing with the mutton stew, and everybody was being sick. The whole deck was slippy with the... where people had sort of, and we had a bag, a black paper bag to be sick in. Well, they didn't last us very long. We filled those up and threw them, and there wasn't any more. We just the only bag we got, and the signs were too high to be sick over, and they were terrible. This mutton stew. Now mutton stew smells terrible at any time. But when you're feeling like that under the weather, it was dreadful. So what we really had some emergency rations of chocolate in a gold-coloured tin, emergency pack. Well, we were so hungry, we debated on ourselves whether to open it or not, because an emergency. But in the end, we did. When we got the chocolate out, it was about an inch thick. And it was so hard that you couldn't break it with your teeth. You had to use some sort of a knife to break bits off. So we did use that. And also we opened the compo boxes, which was the boxes of rations. And I tried to eat some porridge. The porridge was in square blocks like oxo. And I ate some of the porridge. And I also ate some meat, like an oxo cube, and it was supposed to make a meal. But I ate it raw, and I was sick because it was so highly concentrated that it was you couldn't eat them. You had to have water with them. We didn't eat very well on there. We had plenty of tea. We made plenty of tea. Sandwiches, of course, we could make sandwiches. I think they gave us a lot of sandwiches. But the mutton stew we couldn't look at. Some of them did, of course. Some of them have stomachs like I don't know what. But we couldn't face the mutton stew.
Were you given a ration which you weren't supposed to touch unless it was an emergency?
Yes, this chocolate was one of them. I think that was the only thing we had. It was an emergency ration. It was a 24-hour pack. We had a 24-hour pack which you daren't open. That was the first 24 hours after you landed, which was kept intact. You didn't touch that. That was. I think you would have got court-martialed if you'd opened that. Or we were threatened with all kinds of things if we touched those before we landed. They said we wouldn't get anything to eat for the first 24 hours until we wouldn't have time to cook anything. So that was to keep us going. And that's, I don't think actually we used them. But it was in case of emergency. That's what you had.
What was the American crew like? Did you get much chance to?
We didn't get much chance to talk to them. But we were so busy among ourselves. They kept themselves to themselves. I don't think there was many on. I don't think we saw many. I don't think the crew. There's much of a crew. There was an officer up the top, and the bridge which we never saw. Our officers were up there with him some of the time, chin wagging, probably drinking gin. I don't know, but. However, we didn't see much of the American crew at all.
You say your officers, were these your troop officers? Were you one troop on that?
My troop officer was Mr. Edwards. Was Lieutenant Edwards. You said what was you? I was in the colonel's troop, but the colonel wasn't a troop officer. I said, well, it would, the senior rank in the troop was the colonel, but he wasn't the troop officer. The troop officer was Mr. Edwards, and we went into action. I think our main function was to protect the colonel's tank, who didn't have a gun on, just a wooden replica, so he wouldn't stand out as being something different, as Lord Nelson did. He looked like an ordinary tank, but he wasn't. He didn't have a gun. I think our main function was to, when you were harboured up at night or anyway, our main function was to protect him. And also, when we went into action, you went in with one of the other troops, with A squadron or B squadron. And sometimes HQ, our HQ troop led in the order of march, in the order of attack. When the crew commanders came or the troop leaders came, 4th troop will lead or our HQ troop will lead. Different ones led.
So Edwards was your troop commander. What was he like?
He was all right, and he's still alive. And when we went over to Normandy, and the sad part of it was I didn't realise that was a Mr. Edwards. They look so different now. I wish I'd made myself known to him. I was on the video camera doing shots, and his wife's very, very nice, and she took over the camera in BO for a while I did some talking and voiceovers on there. But I didn't realise that it was Mr. Edwards. They were officers, and you didn't have any contact at all with officers. But they were gods, and you just didn't talk to them. You never spoke to an officer unless he spoke to you first. We did have to cook for our officer. When we were in Normandy, when we were preparing a meal and making tea, we had to look after our officer, which was Mr. McMichael. But when we lagered up, of course the officer's mess came up, and he went off with the officer's mess, and we just stopped and cooked for ourselves. But you took him his tea, and he took his turn at making tea. He did, and I'm sure most of the others did. That when you stopped for a cup of tea, he would take his turn at making tea.
So you functioned as a really closely knit troop, a small group of tanks.
Yes, yes.
And you had your officer commanding the troop. Do you recall your other tank commanders in your troop on board that LCT on the way to France?
The other tank commanders. Well, there was Mr. Edwards. There was in our HQ, there was only 4 tanks. And there was Mr. Edwards was one. Mr. McMichael was the other. The Earl of Faversham would be another, and the Colonel would be another.
Who was the Colonel again?
The Colonel was Mr. Harrop. Now, there was a rather funny story about Major. But I don't remember. I don't remember the colonel being on the landing craft, and I didn't know where he was, and I wasn't really interested, but I can't remember seeing him on there. Now, it was only afterwards, only recently, that it's come out that he'd gone with one of his friends on one of the DDs, and met up with Balaclava, which was his tank, on the beaches afterwards. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But he, that's what they said. Now, he was killed on the 16th of June, 10 days after we landed, and of course the regiment then was taken over by the second in command, which was the Earl of Faversham, whose stately home is at in North Yorkshire. Just Hemsley. Just as you go into Hemsley over the bridge, there's a stately home up on the left, and that's where he's dead now. He died in the 60s, but I visited his stately home and said that I was in the regiment because his portrait is in there, and his wife was still alive at that particular time.
Who were the people, do you recall, that were in your crew, your own tank crew?
I can't remember them all. There was myself, there was Mr. McMichael, who was the crew commander. The wireless operator was Corporal Fowler, and the gunner was Roberts, a Welsh lad called Roberts, a stocky built, happy going lad.
And did you get on well together?
Oh, we got on very, very well. I've never seen them. I've heard that Mr. McMichael, I was making inquiries about him only yesterday. See, we speak to each other now. We nearly all have telephones in now, so we can contact each other on a weekend when it's cheap to ring people. And I was talking to one of the chaps and asked him about Mr. McMichael. He died 2 years ago. But we got on very, very well. The Earl of Faversham was a funny sort of a chap. Mr. Harrop, who died, Colonel Harrop, was a marvellous chap. But the Earl of Faversham was a funny sort of a chap. Now, the chap that took over from him was Mr. Neave, Mr. Julius Neave, who was still alive, and he was second in command, who I think was from a big banking family, in London.
In what ways was the Earl of Faversham a funny chap?
Well, he was a chap that was an aristocrat, and he would shout for a bath. And one of the chaps, they had an old bath. They found an old bath somewhere, and it was on one of the sop beakers. And they would rig this bath up, and everybody would be boiling water. This was when you were out on a rest or packed up maybe for a couple of days, and they would. Boiling water, everybody was boiling water and taking it for the Earl of Faversham's bath. And of course he was there for everybody to see, you know, you could see him having his bath. But he was always wanting baths, you know, that was one of his things, you know. And it wasn't easy. We had a terrible job getting a bath. We did have bath units. And are we running out of sequence or what?
We'll come to this. At the moment, I just want to get a picture of the troop and the regiment as it is about to land. Its constitution, so how it's made up and so forth.
Yes.
From the point of view of personnel, the Earl that you mentioned, was he a good leader? Was he effective in the time you had him?
No,
we're jumping ahead, but I'm thinking more in terms of the personality at this stage.
Well, you see, what can I say? I'm only a troop driver. I don't think he got on very well. I've read the diaries of Mr. Julius Neave, who was second in command. They used to play cards a lot in the evenings, the colonel and him, and a few more of the officers. If we'd been caught playing cards for money, we would have been court-martialed. But in his diaries, he says, I lost £20 last night. Fav or the name of, he had a name, he did well, he won this, that and the other. And we sent one of the officers, David, back to Reims for a lot of champagne. Their war was not quite the same as what our war was. We were living in up to the up our neck in mud and things, but they seemed to find themselves a decent billet where there was some civilian cookery and bottles of champagne floating about. It was a, and we didn't know this until reading the diaries of Major Neave, and I think, well, this is ridiculous, you know. If that's true, they didn't have a bad war, you know, not compared with us being wet and tired all the time.
So if you didn't know that at the time, you wouldn't resent it?
Oh, we didn't know, so we didn't resent it. We thought everybody was living rough the same as what we were.
How long was the journey to France?
2 days.
So by the end of 2 days, you would be pretty well...
We would have given anything to be off. We just wanted to be off. Well, it was all... actually, going from Southampton was all night. But we'd been on the water for a couple of days. And then... our stomachs were all inside out when we could, we were given anything to be off. And we were glad to get off the landing craft.
Can you recall the going over, which would be quiet except for engines or what have you, and the start of the bombardment, you know, that period there, you were right at the very front.
Yes. Now, we remember...
Did you see much of the Armada around you when you were at sea?
Not really. They were all behind us. But we heard this terrible bombardment go up, and we were told afterwards that it was the two battleships, the Black Prince, and I think it was the Rodney, shooting over our heads into the... onto the beach, further in, and then it took us about an hour to go in. We were about 3 miles out. The DDs were about three. I think they said it was 3,000 meters, or which is, you know, to three mile to swim in, which is about an hour's run.
So the tank itself was about driving through
about an hour.
For about an hour.
Yeah.
Now, whilst that was going on, we'll come back to that scene again later. While that was going on, all this hell was let loose, presumably. You know, what was going on? I mean, you were in the tank, admittedly, and you couldn't see anything.
We couldn't see or hear anything.
You couldn't hear anything.
Because we were under the water, 11 feet under. And it was just nerve wracking. It was just a matter of keeping your foot hard down. I mean, you weren't driving, you were just keeping your foot down.
And, did any water come in?
No water came in at all. See, you were waterproofed, and you had the skirt round as well. So even if the skirt had been down and you'd gone through 6 foot of water, you still wouldn't have got water in. Now, one of the tanks, when you eventually felt your tracks hit the beach, and of course you think, well, that's it, I'm at the beach. In front of you, you've got a tad coming in behind you, and you've got mines in front of you. It's a queer choice. One of them stopped there, and he didn't know whether to go on. And then Sergeant Ratter's tank passed him, so he thought, "Oh well, it's all right." But by that time, his driver was shouting that the sea was coming over the top of him. I think they'd let the thing down, and Harry Bourne, who was the driver, he was shouting, his feet were getting wet, the water was coming in. So by the time they decided to move, it was too late. The engine had been flooded, so they all had to bail out. That was Pat Hennessy's tank. Now, he joined the regiment when he was only 16. He joined the army when he was only 16. And he finished up. He finished up as a very high rank in the wing commander in the Air Force. He left the army after the war, joined the Navy, joined the Air Force, and finished up as a wing commander.